everyone. Welcome to the Rosie and Bill Show. Lacey J. Dalton made a name for herself in Nashville back in the 1980s, charting numerous top 40 hits. And she's still going strong today, having just released a new album. Lacey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rosie. Thanks, Bill. It's good to be here. Thank you for having us.
It's our pleasure, Lacey. And I'll tell you, you know, we look back at your career, and then we look at kind of the format of our show. And the difficult part for us is, how do we tell the story and do your career justice in the time we have? We're going to make a commitment to do the best that we can. But you made it kind of tough because you've done a lot for a lot of years, and we're big fans. Just want to get that out of the way right away.
Thank you.
And what we'd like to do to kick things off is, many of our fans that have followed us for a long time of the show know that we're in suburban Philadelphia. So to start things off, we're going to take a little bit of a trip north up the turnpike and back in time just a little bit to a town where my son went to college and where you were born, Bloomsburg. Bloomsburg, PA. So Lacey, what was it like growing up in Bloomsburg, and when did music enter the picture for you?
Music was always part of my life because I came from a country music family. My dad played all the stringed instruments, and my mother played guitar and sang harmony, and my sister played piano and wrote songs, and I did nothing. I sat under the big, giant oak table that we had in the kitchen, leaned up against that center pedestal, and listened until I was about 17 years old, and there was a play at the high school, and my family was the only family that even had a guitar. Somebody needed to play a guitar for this play that I was in. So my father taught me a few chords, which was the beginning. I'm sure I was just absolutely horrible. But we got through it, and it was the beginning. I thought, I think I kind of like this. You know, it wasn't in my plan to do this for a living. I wanted to be a wildlife illustrator, and later went out to Brigham Young University because they have a fabulous art department there. And if you're not Mormon, they do everything in the world. I think it's, back then it was only $250 a year tuition to go to that school. And they have this art department and theater department. Oh, you would have loved it, Rosie. They had an art department where they could do Peter Pan, Ticket to Fly, and they had they could actually sink a ship on that stage, and had wonderful art department. And it's actually in a very beautiful setting in the Uinta Mountains, which are, Provo is not too far from Salt Lake City, and it's a really lovely area scenically. So it was an interesting place to go to school. Of course, I fit in the religious community like a square peg in a round hole. And so it was not a particularly good fit for me there. But I loved it. I did love the art classes that I took. And I got to, my job was from 3 to 7 in the morning, cleaning the bathrooms in the art department, which was a couple of miles from where I lived, through gigantic, I remember having to work until 1 or 2 o'clock with homework, and then sleep for an hour or so. My job was from 3 a.m. till 7, cleaning these bathrooms. And in a snowstorm, that meant literally wading through drifts that were as high as my head. So it was not an easy time for me, but I did have some experiences there that I think were very important later on.
It sounds dangerous to send a college student home in drifts of snow like that. I mean, were you ever scared?
No, but I was cold. Back then, you didn't have to worry so much, especially during those kinds of storms. The pedophiles were not out. So you didn't have to worry about that. And you didn't have to worry about traffic because there was no traffic, because the drifts, when it snows out there, it's very, very cold, but the snow is very dry and powdery.
Okay.
So it's not really hard to plunge through it, but I'm sure that I didn't have the kind of clothing. I have stuff for that now because I live at 6,700 feet up by the old town of Virginia City in Nevada. And I have to have that kind of clothing up here for the winter, because when I had horses here on the ranch, you have to go out all, you know, in all kinds of weather to feed and take care of the animals and stuff. So I'm set now. But back then, I don't know how I did it, because I'm really a wimp about cold.
Definitely. What kind of art, before we move into the music, what kind of art did you do?
My dad was a guide on a hunting preserve, and I was very interested in painting wildlife, doing wildlife paintings. It's so strange. I think because I was alone a lot when I was at BYU. I remember at Christmas time, everybody went home because everybody lived not that far from there, at least at most people. There might have been 10 people on that huge campus. I mean, it was just empty. And I remember that I would go over to the art department because I had keys to get in. And the stage, the microphone was live there, all the in this huge, beautiful auditorium. And the lights were on. They left the lights on. And I'd go up on that stage with this guitar and I would play into this microphone. And there was a sort of an exquisite loneliness about it. And I think that was part of why I kind of, I know exactly the moment when I decided I didn't want to be, I couldn't be as good a painter as I wanted to be. I was in an art class and I always was one of the best students in this art class. Would at the time, I'm not trying to be egotistical, but I just had a gift there. And I thought, I think we went out to draw an old barn one day. And I thought, I'm sure that my drawing will be the best. I'm certain that it will be. And when we came in, everybody compared their drawings, their paintings, their sketches, actually. And I noticed that one of the women in my class had noticed that a shingle turned up on the side of the barn, and she had drawn that upturned shingle, and it had so much charm. I hadn't even seen that shingle. And that's when I knew that, if I was good at this one school in this one state in all the world, but there were people who were a thousand times more observant than I was, that this I probably needed to rethink what I was doing because I always wanted to be an artist, always wanted to just be and I kind of just was. I just thought that way and drew things and so on. And so it wasn't very much of it wasn't very much of a sidestep to pick up that guitar and start playing and writing songs.
Wow, that's it's amazing for to have that sort of epiphany and realization when you did that. That says a lot to have that kind of self-awareness. There's a lot of people that aren't very self-aware throughout their life, but for you to pick up on that and kind of make that transition, that's really impressive.
I have noticed during my life that I feel everything all the time. It's hard to be me. I'm very empathic. And so that's difficult for me because I don't see anything. If I meet you, I probably won't remember what you look like or what your name is, but I'll remember what you feel like to me. I'm always sort of down in that place of feeling rather than seeing or hearing or anything. And I've noticed as I've gotten older, I've become more and more aware of that. And it's just the way this model is built, I guess. But it in some ways it's very good because people tell me when I'm singing that they really feel that when I'm really speaking to them, and I really am. So that's the good part of it. The bad part of it is if I meet you in a year or two and you say, "Hi, this is Bill. Remember we had that thing? I'm from Philly and we did that thing." And I'm going, "Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, Phil." And if you provide me with enough detail, I will be remembering how you feel to me, and then I may remember your face. And in one time out of a million, I might remember your actual name. I am, some artists are so good at that. It's such a gift to be able to remember people, to never forget a face and never forget a name. I wish I had that gift because
But
it makes
Lacey, that's so interesting though, because an artist, the painter, is a visual medium. The fact that that's not what you hone in on is almost like a dichotomy. You know what I mean?
Precisely. And I really realized that when I saw that beautiful drawing with the shingle on the roof that had been blown sort of up into the in stick sort of stuck out on the side of the roof. And that was a moment for me of just a realization that you might want to be looking at a different direction.
Once you made that transition or that realization and started going towards music, what was the time frame from when that sort of epiphany and that transition happened for you and when you signed that first record deal?
Oh, that was a long, much long time later. Because I never signed my record deal until I was in the eyes of Nashville, this ancient thing. I think I was 33 when I signed my record deal, and that was a scandal. It was just a scandal how somebody, of that age could actually get a record deal. I don't know if it's still that way. I think it isn't, but back then it was like, this you were considered quite old at 33.
One of the things that I think is so interesting, Lacey, and there's so many just interesting chapters in your career and things that you've done, as I said at the outset. And one of them is that I think is a really intriguing story is you sign that first record deal as Jill Crosston, but then Jill becomes the J in your middle name. So how did that evolution from Jill to Lacey J come about?
Well, it was a fight. Billy Sherrill, when I first went to, he was the biggest thing in Nashville. He was the, of course, the great producer who signed George Jones and Tammy Wynette and was Ray Charles' producer almost the end of his life. And he was just the biggest thing in Nashville. And he was the most wonderful man. He was really a patient and an extraordinary producer, the best one I've ever worked with. He really was a genius, but a kind. He never criticized. He just supported. And I think that's why. And he wrote with us. He if you started a song, you wanted to finish it with Billy, he'd sit down and finish it with you. And of course, he had more Million Airplay Awards on his wall. He could have papered his entire house with the BMI awards that he had. So it was a joy to write with him. I learned a lot from him. He insisted that I change my name. He said, look, he said, I'm signing you. I said, I like the way you sing. I like your voice. He said, I'm signing you because I like the way you write. And you are an outlaw. And I want you to have a voice and a sound that's, I want you to have a name that sounds like an outlaw. And I said, I don't think I want to change my name. And he said, well, I think you should. He said, nobody can remember Jill Croston. They're saying Croston and Crouton and everything else. He says, like, that's not a good name. And it doesn't sound like an outlaw. So come back to me with a name that sounds like an outlaw. I said, do I have to? I suppose then I'm going to have a boob job and blonde hair. Okay. Right? Is that how it goes here? And he just laughed. But he said, no, but you need a different name. You need to sound like the outlaw that you are. So, I went back and there was back and forth on, we were having, I was talking to my manager, not him, and he was talking to my manager, not me. And we had another friend out in California that was interfering, kind of helping us get the thing together. But we ended up, I walked back into the office because my first partner, guitar partner's first ex-wife's name was Lacey B. Walker. And I told him, I'd said to my partner, if I ever have to change my name, I'm going to be Lacey B. Walker, because that's just a great name. So I proudly took that into to Billy Sherrill. And I'll never forget what he said. And in his nasal voice, he goes, no, you're not. Not going to be a Walker. Too many Walkers in the music business. Find a different last name. I like the Lacey. And my manager at the time, David Wood, insisted that I put the J in, which I always thought was kind of hokey. I really thought, really? Lacey J. Dalton. Really? I have to be Lacey J. Dalton. But, and the Dalton came from a woman whose work I admired very, very much and somebody I lived with out in New York who had actually been one of the people who taught Bob Dylan how to play guitar. And she is in his book. And she was an incredible singer. She sounded like Billie Holiday, only she was from Oklahoma and she was a half Cherokee Indian. But her name was Karen Dalton. And I thought, okay, I'll honor Karen because Karen had the best phrasing of anybody that I ever knew. And still, to this day, if you listen to her music, her phrasing is extraordinary. And so I thought I will honor her. So I became Lacey J. Dalton.
That's such a great story, and I give you a lot of credit for being willing to let go of your name and kind of surrender to the business in that regard. Lacey, out of all the many famous people that you have sung duets with, is there any experience or anyone that stands out to you as especially memorable?
Well, you know, with the people that I've been fortunate enough to sing duets with, that's a very hard question because every single one of them had something that happened that was really memorable. But of course, I would have to say that my favorite duet was with Willie Nelson on his Half Nelson album, a song that was a wonderful outlaw song written by a woman named Dee Moeller called Slow Moving Outlaw. And to this day, that song is still, it's still very current because it's, you know, with all the changes and all the railroads shutting down and things changing and the world rearranging and things, you know, just constantly, we've gone into an electronic world that is a complete departure from anything we knew before. And the question of the song is, where does a slow-moving, once quick-draw outlaw got to go? And so, and I'm at that point in my life where I'm asking that, where, you know, where do you go? You know, how do you deal with so many people? There are so many more people in the world today than there were 30, 40 years ago. It's astonishing to me. When I go to Nashville and you see those, it's wound with those six lane freeways all around the city and everybody's driving 80 miles an hour. It's like, holy cow. When I
that
was
is
there,
such a poignant lyric, though. It really is. And it stands the test of time, as you said.
Yeah, Dee is a wonderful writer. She has another song I want to record. After I finish, I'm working on a project now that's very near and dear to my heart. It's called For the Black Sheep. And the first single was called The Devil by a Different Name. And that song was a way of my saying to myself and to all of us, look at what we're doing right now. You know, call me left wing, call me right. We are split right down the middle in this fight. Divided we fall. That rule don't change. It's just the devil by a different name, boys. The devil by a different name. And there are things in that song, you know, call me brown skin, call me white. You know, it's not the color of our skin that makes us right. And if somebody tells you we're not the same, that's the devil. The devil by a different name, boys. The devil by a different name. We need to look at these things that we're doing, these things that are dividing us that are so silly.
That are I got so chills when you were saying that. I got chills.
Well, I hope someday you get to hear the song. I hope someday that you'll get to experience it. It was our first single from the Black Sheep Project. We had then another single that I wrote a very long time ago. When my mother was passing, I wrote a song called Summerland about the other side.
And they say this wide old river has peaceful black.
This song, this whole project is kind of not religious by any means in nature, but kind of spiritual in nature. It's something that I really feel I have to do, and we're getting toward the end of it now. I have a song called Love Yourself that I think I will release next, and then I have some other funny songs. One of them is called Everybody Loves to Hate. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing of, you know, jeepers. You know, we all, so many of us call ourselves Christians, but we also fall prey to the divisiveness that's happening, and we have hatred. You know, we're going, I don't believe that. I love your neighbor. Really? It's hardly what we do. It's hardly what we're doing. So these songs aren't just written out to other people. They're written into me too, because I'm guilty of everything that I write about. That, you know, when I really look into my heart, there are times when, you know, somebody whose views are so different from mine, and they're so adamant, will not cross. One of the songs I'm writing is, we've got to build bridges. We've got to learn how to build bridges, not walls, bridges. We have to learn to come together again. Like we have, I really think in the past, we have been much less divisive than we are now. And I think that divisiveness in America is a terrible, sad thing. So the writing of For the Black Sheep is around those kinds of things, around, you know, let's see, we have a lot more in common than we have differences. And we need to remember that, particularly if we call ourselves Christians, particularly.
Amen. You know, Lacey, I think that I can't think of a better time for those lyrics and those sentiments to be expressed. And I'm looking forward. Devil by a Different Name, I've listened to, I've watched the video, listened to it many times, and it is powerful. And as Rosie said, get those chills with some of those lyrics. I also really enjoyed, you put out an album not that long ago. It's got a lot of your hits on it. Can't Tell My Heart Who to Beat For, Can't Tell Your Heart Who to Beat For. And so you've got, everywhere I look, you've got music, either previous hits coming out, new, like, how do you, like, do you ever sleep? Like, you've got so many things going on right now.
Well, it is pretty busy, but I've had so much help from Time Life. They really have helped me get out and get around and get the music out. There's so much music that I've made that no one has ever heard. I probably have four full projects. I was with Universal Records, and I was with Jimmy Bowen, who was then, after Billy Sherrill, became the biggest thing in show business because he was the man who signed Garth Brooks. So his record company had Garth Brooks, and he put me on his boutique labels, and he had four of them. I had three or four, and every time we made a record, he would decide to go and create another boutique label and take me to that, and we'd leave that record behind, and nobody ever heard it, nobody ever promoted it, sitting there. So we have four of those, and I tried. Each time I kept thinking, what am I doing wrong? You know, what am I doing? I'm going to try this tack. No, maybe I'll try this time. And so I did a lot of stuff with that. And finally, after having those four, truly, it felt like miscarriages, I finally went, it's time for me to leave Nashville to become independent. And I have been independent for, what, 20-something years now. And I was very, very honored and surprised. We came back to Nashville to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the song 16th Avenue, which was probably at least one of my biggest hits, but certainly the song that most people identify with me. It was written by Tom Schuyler, who is a very dear friend, also from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And a wonderful interview, by the way, if you can ever get him on your show. He's so funny. He's so good. And he's written a million airplay songs. But he wrote 16th Avenue, and we were back there celebrating the 40th anniversary of it. And as a surprise, we were asked to go to the largest award show for independent artists in the country and probably in the world. It's called the Josie Awards.
The Josies.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I know somebody got a Lifetime Achievement Award from them, right?
Well, it was a complete surprise. I had no idea that they even knew who I was, but it was such an honor and such a privilege. And to be on that, the Grand Ole Opry, they do their thing at the Grand Ole Opry on that stage. It's not identified as the Grand Ole Opry when they do it. It's identified as the Josie Awards. But it's the same stage that I'd been on a night or two before singing 16th Avenue. And the Josies, we had a wonderful performance on there. And then just a few months ago, I was surprised again because they polled the audience about the performances that had happened that night. And my partner Dale and I won the best performances on that award show where they, I don't know how many people they had perform, but there were a number of people. And so that was another, I keep getting these wonderful surprises. And it's so nice this far down the road when you really have not been, I have not been in Nashville on the TV shows for probably 30 years. That's a long time. When I left there and went to the West, where I was so homesick for the West. It's so wide open out here. And I was born in Pennsylvania, but I knew in my spirit that I belonged in the West. And so I came West and I have stayed here ever since. And it's been the best decision. It's been very, very good for me here. But I still have these wonderful ties to Nashville. And when I go back there, I kind of feel like I'm like the weird cousin from California that goes back to see the family, because we go on these country cruises and I get to see everybody that I always worked with, you know, people like Johnny Lee and David Frizzell and T.G. Shepherd and just Jimmy Fortune. I just so many of these wonderful Mo Bandy and Joe, not Joe. I haven't seen Joe. I want to see Joe Stampley, but I see Mo every time I go. And it's wonderful for me to see everybody because I never go back unless I'm doing some sort of a performance there. I pretty much stay out here. I live way up in the mountains. I'm sort of reclusive now. I have three great big dogs, and I live in this big timber peg house that rocks. And we have heavy winds up here, 70 miles an hour. And this house rocks like a big ship.
Well,
it's not scary at all.
It sounds like it's a muse for you to write your music. And I love what you said about, you know, it's time to be me, and you became an independent artist. But it also sounds like this project that you're working on, the spiritual album, so to speak, the influence of it, really is authentic. And we this theme runs through a lot of artists on our show, and it's like when they really tune into that, which you sound like you have been for a very long time, and you're true to yourself, that's the greatest gift, is to see that realized and put that kind of content, because it is a part of you. And we really look forward to hearing this project.
I'm thrilled to be talking to you, and that's a lovely thing for you to say. And I think that when I am writing these songs and singing these songs, they're pretty deep. You know, I'm looking into my own heart and trying to make sure that what I'm saying is going to be positive for people. This is not an easy place to, this earth is not easy. We have terrible things that happen here. We have heartbreaking things every day, all the time. And we need strength to make it through these hard times, through the tough times. And I think the third single for this CD may be a song that I wrote probably 30 years ago called What Don't Kill You Makes You Strong. And I found that to be true. And I think it's a good thing to say to people. Now, that idea has been sung about many, many times since then. But this will be the first time that I put this song out for the Black Sheep record.
Well, so, we can't wait to hear the Black Sheep record. And Lacey, we thank you so much for coming and talking to us. We love hearing your story. We love to have you back on the show when you get this project finished and you want to promote it. And we just wish you all the best. And folks, thank you for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed the show. And we'll see you next week.
With a million-dollar spirit and an old flat-top guitar, they drive to town with all they own in a $100 car. This one time someone told a mom about a friend of a friend they knew who owns, you know, a studio on 16th Avenue. Son were born to money, they never had to say survive. Had enough to sling a 9-pound hammer just to stay alive. There's cowboys, drunks, and Christians, mostly white, black, and blue. They've all dialed a phone, collect a home from 16th Avenue. Then one night in some empty room where no curtains ever hung, like a miracle, some golden words roll off of someone's tongue. And after years of being nothing, they're all looking right at you. And then for a while you go in style on 16th Avenue. So quiet and discreet, but a lot of lives are changed out on that little one-way street. As they walk away from everything just to sing for me and you. So God bless the boys who make the noise on 16th Avenue. And God bless all the girls who make the noise. Woo! Down on 16th Avenue.